Hello, it's Thursday, 19th of November. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson.
And I'm Gary Bowerman from Check in Asia.
On this week's show, there's only one topic still on our minds, the Hong Kong-Singapore air travel bubble about to take off on 22nd of November.
Yeah, we're getting closer and closer. In today's show, we're going to look at how the pivotal news of the air travel bubble was received across Asia and worldwide, and whether it's inspired any more countries to take the plunge. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. We're still buzzing on the news about the Singapore and Hong Kong air travel bubble, starting in just 4 days.
4 days, yeah. Seems like it's been going on forever, doesn't it, Hannah? It certainly made some newspaper headlines worldwide, and particularly here in Asia. And it's caused some heated discussions about the safety of travel and opening borders versus, you know, not opening. But it has nudged some countries into thinking a little bit more about their own travel corridors. And it's certainly got some discussions going, as we've seen in countries like Europe at the moment, where the situation is very, very different, Hannah. The response in Asia has obviously been a lot stronger for obvious reasons. But the whole world is looking at this right now. What are your sentiments, you know, 4 days out? What do you think is going to happen?
I mean, I think at this point, neither side can really back down unless there's suddenly a big spike. And of course, you know, there have been some more locally transmitted cases in Hong Kong, so, you know, that is a question mark over it. But, you know, I think both sides just want to get it started and perhaps use that then as a springboard to start discussions with other partners, other countries, and seeing how else they can expand this travel bubble. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think looking at the reactions from Singapore and Hong Kong, and we'll come on to those in a moment, you know, there's general positivity. There is concerns, that, and certainly there are concerns about things like flight prices, but particularly the safety elements. As we said on the pod last week, Hannah, you know, this has been rigorously strategized. They have put in every single safety procedure that they believe is possible. COVID has been relatively well managed between the two countries. But as you say, like these small outbreaks, we look at both Australia and New Zealand, and we look at Singapore and Hong Kong, the two countries that have instituted some degree of bubbles so far. And all of those four countries are very, very focused on maximum suppression. So even small numbers of cases are going to have an impact, not just on government policy, but on public perception. And that's something I think we're going to have to deal with for the coming months. Small numbers of outbreaks do cause concern.
Yeah, absolutely, at this point. I mean, and it's funny, isn't it? Because I think when we're in Asia, in Southeast Asia, and we talk about small numbers of outbreaks, we really mean very small. I think if you were listening and you're in Europe or you're in America, you would probably be laughing at the, you know, the number of cases that are causing concern. You know, just 10, 13, they would be, what? We've got so many more than that. But there is just that general paranoia, I think, in Asia and Southeast Asia, and that, you know, I guess because we were hit first as well and we were so close to China and you saw the impact of that, that just any small number of cases is enough to set off that fear about a second wave, a third wave, a fourth wave, even whatever number wave you're on.
I agree with you there. And I think we'll kick off the media coverage. I picked up an article from Reuters, I think, a couple of days ago. And the headline says, Asia at a crossroads in fight against coronavirus as cases surge. It's exactly like you say, Hannah, in terms of the surging number of cases, and some of the countries referred to, they're quite small. So it refers to Japan, Korea, Australia, New Zealand, and China. But as we said, you know, just a few months ago there, is these countries are really, really focused on getting those cases right down to zero and keeping it at zero. Japan is probably the country that's struggling the most at the moment. It reported that, you know, Japan is facing mounting pressure to reimpose a state of emergency, and while South Korea is warning that it's at a critical crossroads. So there is this issue of, you know, keeping these vaccine numbers so, so low, but the economic impact of not allowing any travel or even just very, very restricted numbers of essential business travel is really starting to hurt. And as we turn into the first quarter of 2021, you know, the economic impact of 2020 will roll over into 2021, and governments are going to be very, very aware of that.
Yep, definitely. I mean, in Singapore, I think we can say that it was pretty well received, the news. I think a lot of excitement in the media about it. And certainly Channel News Asia were saying they had an article forming an air travel bubble with Singapore after Hong Kong, which destination could be next? Looking to see where they could, you know, what experts thought that the next destination could be. And there were destinations tipped like New Zealand, Australia, China, Thailand, Vietnam, Taiwan. Lots going on there, but it's all just speculation at this point. It's experts, but they don't really know what's going on behind the scenes.
Well, that was an interesting part of this, really, was that as soon as that announcement was made and then the official details about the implementation, you started to see this sort of rush of articles of saying, well, who will be next? Who's going to be doing these travel bubbles with who and where and at what point? And then all of a sudden that went a little bit quiet, didn't it, over the earlier days of this week when the coronavirus numbers started to look a bit more menacing. We also had, there was obviously that big interruption last weekend with the ASEAN summit, which also took in five other countries around the region. They had to focus really on getting the regional economic cooperation program over the line. So that kind of took precedence over opening bubbles. But it's interesting looking at the media in both Singapore and Hong Kong, because there is definite excitement. You know, there's a lot of coverage where you get the tourism boards and the airlines being very positive and upbeat about this, perhaps to some degree the travel agencies as well. But then you do get a sort of underlying concern that, you know, let's just get this up and running and hope for the best. You kind of get an impression from the media.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, if we contrast the South China Morning Post, some of the articles they were coming out with last week, particularly the columns, there's one columnist titled, "Even with the travel bubble, it may be best to stay home." Another one, "Relaxation of border controls must not be at the expense of health." You know, and then the final one, "Hong Kong tourism firms upbeat but cautious over scheme with Singapore." So I think South China Morning Post are definitely taking a slightly more kind of cautious, more safety conscious approach to this travel problem.
Yeah, I think it's difficult. I think, you know, after, where are we now, 10, 11 months of this, we've been talking about this every week throughout. So is everybody in the travel industry. And views are polarized. You know, people who don't travel are concerned about travelers coming into their destinations. That's kind of natural, I think. And, you know, this, we've had such relentless coverage about the dangers of coronavirus and, you know, in the last week or two, particularly with the Pfizer and the Moderna results in terms of vaccine. China is also seemingly reporting pretty strong positivity about its vaccine. The Oxford AstraZeneca is about to present its results. So there is this idea that, you know, well, the ultimate solution to this probably is going to be a vaccine. And in the meantime, are we rushing too fast into opening up these travel bubbles? And you can understand why people do feel that way. But then there's the overriding economic agenda, which, you know, is impacts us all, whether you're in travel or not. The knock-on effects of not opening travel affects so many industries and will continue to do so.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they keep saying 1 in 10 of the world's jobs are in tourism. So when that is suffering, inevitably, that's going to drag the entire economy down. So, you know, as we keep saying, it's this decision between opening up, saving the economy, or potentially saving lives. And like you say, perhaps some countries are just willing now to wait it out. You know, they can kind of see the light at the end of the tunnel with the vaccines and just say, do you know what? We're just going to grit our teeth and get through the next 6-9 months before we can start, you know, before we have the whole country vaccinated. Perhaps that's that.
That is really on point. And I think you're starting to see that from some of the lobby groups in the travel industry that, you know, they are so far apart from many governments in terms of the way they're trying to push this, which brings us neatly into the Association of Asia Pacific Airlines, which this week made a joint declaration with the International Air Transport Association, IATA, and the Airports Council International Asia Pacific. They presented a joint publication on the 16th of November. And the statement said, "We support the establishment of globally accepted, standardized, and mutually recognized COVID-19 testing protocols, which we view as critically important additional risk mitigation layer in support of a safe and timely recovery of international air travel. Now, why are they saying this? They go on to say, the air transport sector accounts for 3.1% of Asia-Pacific GDP and supports nearly 50 million jobs. That's just the air transport sector alone. And it adds that it urgently needs regional coordination mechanisms to overcome the unprecedented damage to the travel and tourism sectors, including the widespread loss of livelihoods in many communities across the region. Now, I don't know what you think, Hannah, but that to me sounds like a real cry for help. In fact, that you've got to listen to us, because although this is damaging those numbers of jobs, those number of livelihoods in the travel and tourism sectors, the knock-on effect through 2021 across whole economies will be huge. And you do just get the feeling that there's a big difference between the travel industry and governments right now, who do seem to be looking very much towards channeling their resources and their mindsets in towards vaccination programs.
Yeah, I think that there is that difference. I mean, it was, I quite liked what the AAPA had to say actually about the Singapore Hong Kong travel bubble, and they were saying they hoped that it will be a spark for other countries, and they said that they really want these countries to be pursuing an equal risk, equal response strategy, which I thought kind of summed up the Singapore Hong Kong kind of approach to this travel bubble quite nicely. Equal risk, equal response.
But I wonder what you think about this, Hannah. I'm wondering now whether a lot of countries that might look at travel bubbles, particularly in our region, are waiting for Singapore and Hong Kong, or maybe they already have, to approach them. So they actually become part of a bigger bubble. So, you know, Singapore and Hong Kong will lead the way, and they will negotiate with other countries. It could be, I don't know whether it would be Vietnam or Thailand or whatever, rather than, say, Thailand going and independently doing a bubble with another country. You wonder whether they want to be integrated in some sort of bigger bubble, because if they go and do these independent deals on their own steam, you know, they would then be precluded from a Singapore-Hong Kong air travel bubble, which, as we said last week, may in future include countries, I don't know, perhaps China, perhaps Australia, so that it brings in a bit more regional focus to it. I just wonder what you think about that.
You know, that it could be. It could be that. But there's still almost this, I think particularly in ASEAN, we don't tend to see governments really collaborating with one another so much. I know that we have the ASEAN, and we'll talk about ASEAN travel corridors in a bit. But I do get the feeling that it's each country out for themselves. I don't feel like it's that they would almost trust another country to have all of the protocols in place and ready. You know, they want to go out and they want to do it themselves, perhaps. I feel a little bit at the moment.
I mean, the country that is being most progressive on this is Singapore. The country that seems to be have the really good handle on it is Vietnam, but it seems to be reluctant to get involved in too many external deals at the moment. Thailand's still persisting. We'll come to Thailand in a minute, but it's still persisting with its quarantine requirement. So, you know, that would preclude it from being in a travel bubble, simply the fact that it has a quarantine requirement. So, yeah, I mean, it's a good point. And then you have other countries across the region that are struggling, which, you know, we know which ones they are. There's a lack of regional integration. So I guess that brings us up to, Hannah, the statement of the weekend from ASEAN about a travel corridor, which was a bit half-hearted and doesn't really say a great deal, does it?
No. So they said, essentially, that they have agreed they will take steps towards the establishment of an ASEAN travel corridor arrangement framework to facilitate essential business travels. And for me, the emphasis really there is on take steps. This is not them saying that they are going to do this. This is saying that they're going to look into doing this, which is kind of miles apart. And it's not surprising, is it? You know, as we keep saying, Asia or Southeast Asia is currently on three different speeds in terms of recovery, very different containment responses, very different risk. Certainly, it wouldn't fit this equal risk, equal response idea at all. And when you don't have that, it's very difficult to be able to come out with and agree on opening up travel across ASEAN.
As we've discussed before, ASEAN is very consensual based organization, they don't really like taking big decisions. And as you said there, although they're talking about a corridor arrangement framework, which is quite overblown, they then caveat that by saying, why prioritizing public health and safety? So they seem to be caught between two senses here. And they go on to add that they want to develop a common set of pre-departure and post-arrival health and safety measures. But, you know, you're thinking, well, shouldn't that have been done by now? I mean, it's almost December. They've had plenty of time to try and discuss these. It does seem very much as though this is just sort of papering over the divisions rather than actually creating something going forward.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I mean, we saw this a few months ago, didn't we, at the last ASEAN summit that I don't think they made a declaration at that point, but again, they discussed this ASEAN travel corridor. It's something they keep discussing. It's something that we've seen no movement towards. So it's something that I'm really very pessimistic about that could come off, actually.
Yeah, well, I have to say I agree with you. And particularly as the fact that Singapore has gone its own way and done this deal with Hong Kong, you know, it does show that they had to do that for themselves. And other countries are probably going to have to sort of fend for themselves in some ways, unless, as I mentioned before, you know, they become part of Singapore's wider bubble.
Yeah. So should we have a look at, we had some reactions on LinkedIn to the Hong Kong-Singapore travel bubble news. So one interesting one that we had from Emmy Abdul Alim, who's the managing editor at Salam Gateway based in Singapore, said that these reports don't factor in the people who live in these cities. Speaking from the ground, and that's in Singapore, I can say that not everyone's thrilled, and a lot of people in Singapore are nervous about these arrangements, including entries from China with no 14-day stay-home notices. So that's something, actually. You know, we often, like we keep saying, we're seeing it from the tourism industry point of view, but there is that reticence, that fear amongst people who are living in Singapore and Hong Kong about opening up and what that means, you know, in terms of their kind of newly found freedoms as well, if they have to go back just so someone can go, if they have to go back into lockdown just so a few people can go on holiday, you know.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the outcomes this year, is this big psychological hurdle. You know, and not just for people that live in the destinations, it's about travelers. You know, we read quite a lot about, you know, how the flights are booked and, you know, there's pent-up demand and stuff. But it's quite hard to judge that based on the numbers in this bubble, because they're so small. The daily flight numbers between the two cities are so small that you'd probably expect that they would be overbooked, just in terms of people who want to get back to see family or for work reasons or something like that, even discounting the fact of leisure travel. So we don't really know whether the travel sentiment surveys that we read, you know, they tell the actual truth of, yes, people want to travel when they actually have the ability to do so. And you look at the protocols and the testing procedures that you have to go through. It's not travel like we used to know it. Is there going to be a bit of reticence there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was looking on the Facebook comments of, you know, Straits Times and South China Morning Post when they posted about this news, just to see what locals were thinking. And there was a lot of skepticism about it. There were a lot of people saying, wow, this is expensive. I don't really want to have three tests just to be able to go on holiday. There's definitely this fear of having a very uncomfortable, quite invasive nasal swab test. People don't like the thought of that at all. Having to hang around at the airport for test results. Yeah, there's definitely the inconvenience factor. And I think people, you know, I spoke to a travel agent in Singapore yesterday and I asked him whether he'd seen any impact from this. And he said, no, not really. No one's biting. No one's confirming anything yet.
Right. As we did say last week, Hannah, on the pod, you know, we do have to give this time. It's you know, this is, we've come from no travel basically in 8 or 9 months to reopening on a very, very small scale. And we have to see how the industry and people react to this. And on that sort of cautious note, Brett Henry, who's president and director of MG Group based in Jakarta, says, it's a start. We need leaders to show the way to restarting leisure travel. We can expect bumps, but also rapid learning as the two city states work to get it right and quickly grow the traffic. This pilot provides a platform for follow-on openings to other risk markets. So I think that is what we were saying a few moments ago, Hannah, wasn't it? That this is just the first piece of the jigsaw, essentially.
Yeah, Yeah, it's a pilot. And Simon Westway, who's the executive director at Australian Tourism Industry Council in Australia, says something quite similar. He says, I do think this bubble will be watched very closely across Asia Pacific, including Australia.
Yeah, and Professor Dr. Wolfgang Art, who is the CEO of the China Outbound Travel Research Institute in Hamburg, he says it's great news, but add vaccination from next month and we're onto a recovery path, but should do it in a better way than pre-virus. Again, that's a really good point, that we're in an interim stage here, Hannah. This is the first stage of moving towards some kind of normalization of travel, but that normalization will most likely come from the vaccination stage.
Yeah. And Joachim Persson, who's the regional sales representative at Helping Hotels based in Phuket, says, at last, certain countries in ASEAN could have started this months ago. I think I can guess which countries he's referring to.
Yeah, that's a good point. And then Kel Willis, who's head of marketing, brand and PR at Silalona Sojourns, which is based in Indonesia. I commented on LinkedIn that I said that, you know, these travel bubbles can only achieve limited objectives without China's participation, simply because the market numbers are going to be quite small. And she replied saying, I think the industry will have to find any stock gaps with so many traditional key markets saying they are likely to be affected as far away as 2022. The biggest concern is not so much who the travel bubbles will be with, but also what money they will bring both into both the local economy and into the industry. I still have my doubts that the Chinese market can really be even more than a blip on the map needed to boost the industry, especially with the bubbles being so defined. It will take time to see for sure, but right now all change is a step in a direction we were not in a few months back. I think that sums it up.
Yeah, that does. Thanks, Kel, for that. Definitely. I mean, and that also, it kind of, that sentiment reminds me a little bit of this new travel bubble that has being proposed or is going to be implemented between Qatar and Maldives. So this is quite an interesting one. So essentially, Qatar Airways have negotiated this travel bubble, and they are flying with no quarantines. Qatar travelers can stay in two luxury properties, which would just be dedicated for Qatar Airways passengers, and they're calling it travel bubble holidays. And it's almost that concept, isn't it? Yes, those two hotels are going to benefit from this. Qatar Airways is going to benefit from this. But does the local community at large actually get much benefit from this travel agreement? Probably not really, unless you're the island next door and you've got no passengers, you've got no guests.
Yeah, well, that takes us back. We mentioned this on the pod a few weeks ago when we did our original travel bubbles pod. We looked at private travel bubbles, didn't we? And there were a couple at the time that were being suggested. One was a group of Singaporean investors that were looking to do something similar in Maldives. And then there was a Russian travel agency that was trying to bring in Russian tourists to a part of Vietnam. Those both seem to have gone a little bit quiet. But you're right. I mean, Qatar has the market prowess to push this one ahead. It's interesting. Does it benefit the greater community? Probably not yet. But I think the point is that we have to get into a position of a start point. And once you start getting travelers comfortable again, get the protocols set up and working in these resorts, then hopefully, and I hate using this phrase, but there could be a trickle-down effect in future. But at the moment, everything is just a test case, isn't it? We're just really trying to find some kinds of solutions for the industry to generate some revenues and to keep businesses alive into the turn of 2021. So let's at this point, Hannah, let's look at Australia and New Zealand, because that was the first travel bubble that really got up and running. It's slightly limited. Well, it's very limited in scope. It's currently only a one-way bubble from New Zealand to Australia. And there were hopes that perhaps in the next couple of months, it would be a two-way bubble. It would become an actual proper bubble. But those hopes seem to have been dashed this week, Hannah.
They do, don't they? So the New Zealand PM has pretty much warned people that it is very, very unlikely that this is going to come off before Christmas. And this is largely down to, she says, the way how Australia and New Zealand both handle COVID cases and their tolerance for the number of COVID cases within a community. So again, it kind of comes down to the how are they responding to it? Do they have an equal response? Well, New Zealand PM doesn't seem to think so at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. So we discussed this again a few weeks ago that, you know, New Zealand has a centralized policy, a national policy of containing the virus. Australia's policy is state by state, and that's given rise to differences between the states and how they actually institutionalize what they call a hotspot. And this week, the spotlight turned onto South Australia, which had an outbreak. I think it was 18 cases on Monday. But the concern about those cases, you know, I guess people around the world will again be saying, well, 18 cases, that's not a huge number. But those cases were believed at the beginning to have emanated from quarantine hotels, which is what happened in Melbourne. If you go back a few months, I think it was in June, that the initial outbreak was traced to the quarantine hotels. That's where there's a huge concern. South Australia's had very, very strict policy. It's had less than 1,000 cases total over the months of COVID-19, but it borders Western Australia. Now, Western Australia has some of the strictest policies in terms of border control over the other states of Australia. It immediately shuttered its border with South Australia and was even warning that it might just shutter its borders again across the whole of Australia. So you have these internal problems as well. But actually managing a two-way bubble into New Zealand from Australia, you'd have to decide where the flights were going to come from. And, you know, Adelaide and Perth were probably two of the primary cities that they would have chosen simply on COVID safety. That looks like it's not going to happen. There are different situations in Sydney and Melbourne, and there's still this bickering going on about whether they really, really push ahead with domestic tourism. I've been speaking to a couple of Australian tour industry professionals this week, and demand is definitely there. The number of bookings and also the number of inquiries are huge. People really want to take breaks. But the political consequences of having this zero COVID policy are just impacting everything.
Yeah, I mean, so South Australia from today have gone into a 6-day lockdown, haven't they? So they are not even allowed to leave the house for exercise or to walk your dogs. So poor dogs, they've got to stay in the house for 6 days. And then after that, I think that they will have lockdown still, but it will be slightly more tolerant policies. So they, you know, that's really shot the travel bubble idea, hasn't it? I think people were starting to get excited with it, with Australia and New Zealand, thinking it could happen. And this is illustrated, just the two governments really need to be on the same page in terms of how they're controlling the virus and what they consider to be an acceptable level of community transmission or not.
Yeah, I agree. Australia's Scott Morrison said, the Prime Minister said this week, that the new cases were a reminder, even after lockdown, even after all this time, the virus hasn't gone anywhere. But then you contrast that with, you look at this situation in Queensland, and Queensland yesterday hosted the State of Origin, the third match in the State of Origin rugby league series between Queensland and New South Wales in Brisbane, and had a full capacity crowd of 52,000 people in the stadium. Now, as an English football fan, you know, that I'm just looking at that in horror. You know, we have empty stadiums across Europe and have had for months. In Brisbane, there was a capacity crowd. But then you look further across the country, and coming up to the big sports season in Australia, it's summer. So you have the Test match cricket season, and you have the Australian Open tennis tournament, which kicks off the tennis season. Internationally, it's known as the Grand Slam of Asia Pacific. It's the only one of the four that takes place in this region. And there are concerns about, you know, stadium numbers for those tournaments. The Boxing Day Test match, which this year will be between Australia and India, normally is 90,000 people in the stadium. I've been there. It's an amazing atmosphere. But this year, that may be 25,000 maximum, which obviously has an impact on not just the stadium atmosphere, but the revenues that can be generated from that. At the moment, the Australian Open tennis tournament, they're still not sure about what they will actually do in terms of crowds. So all these things are just sort of in a mix in one country. And meanwhile, you know, it looks like Australians won't be able to travel to New Zealand for holidays anytime soon, certainly not into 2021.
No, but New Zealanders might be able to go to the Cook Islands, mightn't they? It's looking pretty good, that one. Apparently, the Kiwi officials have gone over to Cook Islands and are assessing everything. Cook Islands haven't had any locally transmitted cases for a while. So they might get another travel bubble off the ground yet before the end of the year.
They will do. But then you look at the obviously the downside to that is Samoa. Samoa had its first COVID-19 case this week. Was a sailor who transited through Auckland, which is quite strange. And then there was a case also in New Zealand this week. They had two cases, I think, yesterday, both imported, of a traveler, an air traveler, who traveled from Moscow, get this, Hannah, traveled from Moscow via London, Qatar, and Brisbane, and then tested positive in Auckland.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I think that says something about how we really need a standardized kind of air travel procedures, don't we? You know, globally. And I think until that's in place, there's going to be that uncertainty, really that uncertainty about whether people are safe or not, whether the testing works or not, until it's really standardized and everybody is following the same procedures, is going to be hard.
Yeah, especially for transit travel. We've discussed this before again, Hannah, the issues of transit travel. I mean, the benefits for Singapore, Hong Kong is it's point to point. There won't be any transit. You'll be flying in and out of the same two airports. So there is, you can control that a lot more easily. You can make sure that the testing is much more controlled. So I think on that basis, Singapore and Hong Kong, in terms of the actual protocol and the mechanisms, looks to be a stronger bet.
It does. It looks pretty robust. So I'm certainly looking forward to seeing what happens on Sunday. Aren't you?
Yeah, fingers crossed. Fingers crossed, Hannah. Let's hope it gets up and running and it works safely and it works successfully.
So that brings us to the end of this edition of the Southeast Asia Travel Show. We hope you enjoyed the show. And as always, we'd love to read your feedback on what we said or missed out. So email us at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com. And look out for our daily travel insights and podcast news on LinkedIn at the Southeast Asia Travel Show and Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Yep. And as this is our 51st edition of the Southeast Asia Travel Show, you can catch up with all 50 previous episodes on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, and Stitcher. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each app.
So that's a wrap for this week. We're both off to track those first flights in real time on Flight Radar on Sunday. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you very soon.
Yeah, thanks very much. Bye-bye.